Now, again, the December surprise is a working hypothesis that I presented originally in January of 1989, and it connects a number of events that I feel are interrelated and that in turn underlie the legal denouement of the Iran-Contra scandal, specifically the dismissal of charges, weapon smuggling charges, against a number of people who appear to have been part of the enterprise and with connecting links to the October surprise, the apparent deal between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini government to hold the hostages from the U.S. Embassy until after Jimmy Carter's election defeat was assured. In return, then originally under Israeli auspices and then more directly, the United States began shipping arms to the Iranians for their war against Iraq. Basically, in a nutshell, the conspiracy charges against Oliver North were dismissed because his defense could not obtain documents, classified documents that they sought. The Reagan administration would not willingly release them. It announced that on December 2nd, the same day that Amiram Nir Nisker, a key Israeli official who had been involved with both Ollie North and George Bush, and who in turn had been working with Oliver North on counter-terror policy in calendar years 1985 and 86, he thereby intersected directly with some of the same people who not only were involved with the Iran-Contra scandal, but who also were mentioned in connection with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, notably Abu Nidal. When Pan Am Flight 103 went down, the documents requested by the North Defense Team thereby became unreleasable, so to speak, to coin a phrase. They became central to the investigation of this outrage, the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, and thereby they could not be released for national security reasons, plus public sentiment. Had the pressure been exerted to have those released, public sentiment would have been totally against it because of the heinous nature of this particular act. In addition, on Pan Am Flight 103, a number of interesting people were killed relevant to the Iran-Contra scandal itself. First of all, there were a number of State Department and U.S. intelligence counter-terror experts who were killed on the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. They might very well have had key information about one aspect or another of the Iran-Contra scandal. Their deaths obviously precluded them giving any testimony they might have given or communicating any information they might have communicated. Beyond that, one of the points that was made in one of the articles read in the original broadcast was that U.S. intelligence in the Middle East and the national security establishment in general found, the intelligence professionals found not only that bombing but a couple of others that killed some key CIA people to be very intimidating. And I hypothesized that I felt that intimidation was one of the strategic goals of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. I think the downing of Amiram Nir, the downing of that plane, the elimination of those officials, aside from the national security aspects that I mentioned earlier, they made the release of the documents North's defense team sought impossible. They also eliminated people and intimidated the living bejesus out of an awful lot of other people who might have been willing to speak up. Also, again, there are other aspects of the December surprise. I feel that the Pizza Connection 4 case, the fourth investigation growing out of the Pizza Connection case, also helped intimidate some people, and the fact that the scope of the bust was limited, it was a damage control situation. The fact that the scope of the investigation was limited and did not go as far as it might have, that precluded the possibility of some things coming out that otherwise might have. Plus, of course, the shooting of the Pope is inextricably linked with the Pizza Connection case in a way that I'll talk about in a second, and that too bears directly on some of the events relating to the Iran-Contra scandal. Well, basically, the Pizza Connection case was a case that broke in 1984. It was a heroin smuggling case in which a number of organized crime outfits, both Italian and Sicilian mafia, or American and Sicilian mafia organizations, were trafficking heroin and marketing it through pizza restaurants in the Northeast and the Midwest. Now, the most important aspect is that the proceeds from this operation, the money from this operation, was being laundered through two key U.S. brokerage houses, Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner, and Smith, headed up for part of the time that this operation was going on by Donald Regan, who went on to become White House Chief of Staff. Also, the other was E.F. Hutton and Company, the division of which that was involved with this was headed up for part of that time by Scott Pierce, George Bush's brother-in-law. Beyond that, there are a number of interesting connections between the Pizza Connection case and the Iran-Contra scandal. In Pizza Connection 2, there was mention of the Medellin cartel, which, of course, intersects with the Iran-Contra scandal. We went into that in RFA number 29. Also, it should be noted that the Shikarchi AG case brings into focus the Pope shooting in connection with the Pizza Connection case, because a key person with regard to Shikarchi AG, a Swiss and Italian-based heroin smuggling and money laundering operation, the key person in that group is also a key person, or in that case, I should say, is also a key person in the Pizza Connection case. That is a guy named Avni Yasser Musalulu. Now, that, in turn, is an alias for Aral Çelik, one of the Grey Wolves, one of the Turkish neo-Nazis who was mentioned in connection with the shooting of the Pope. He was apparently one of Mehmet Ali Aja's conspirators in the shooting of the Pope. Aral Çelik, again, Avni Yasser Musalulu is another name of his. He not only was involved with the Shikarchi AG case and the Pizza Connection case, but he was also described by the Italian press as being the European distributor for Kunsa's heroin, Kunsa being a Shan warlord. Kunsa also, of course, by a number of different accounts, both a conservative source, Bo Greitz, a Green Beret, as well as the Liberal Christic Institute, Kunsa hooked up with Richard Armitage, and, in turn, members of the so-called secret team, as the Christic Institute have referred to them, many of the key players in the Iran-Contra scandal and a number of other apparent operations over the years. So again, the Pizza Connection is in and of itself very complicated, and then when you start working that into the December surprise scenario, which is in and of itself quite complicated, well, that's why I have the archive shows, basically, because there's no way past a point that you can really do justice to this material if you don't log some of it as archives and then proceed into it. Still, though, for people who find this unfathomable or preposterous, again, I think you'll find that if you bear with me and if you get into the archives and once you become familiar with some of these names like Avni Yasser Musalulu and Aral Çelik and the Grey Wolves, etc., it sounds pretty weird at first, particularly since some of those names are foreign to the American linguistic palate. I think you find it when you familiarize yourself with some of the basics, the rest starts fitting into place fairly easily. And again, my apologies if this seems a bit dense for some people, but I think it is comprehensible, and we've got to come to terms with it, so away we'll go here. But again, I realize this is very complicated, and I can only counsel patience and apologize, but it ain't my fault, folks. I don't create these events. In any event, a key person with regard to the prosecution of the Pizza Connection, which did not bring out many of the facts that I have illuminated for you so far, the fact of the matter is that although the information is on the public record, it has not figured into the investigation. Nobody's talking about the Reagan and Bush administrations in connection with the Pizza Connection case, and the fact that the Pizza Connection case also intersects with some of the Iran-Contra people in the Shikarchi AG case, the Stibom arms for drugs ring comes back in, and that in turn figures into the Pope shooting scenario. None of that was gone into by the authorities, and the prosecutor in charge with investigating the Pizza Connection case, the fellow who broke Pizza Connection 4, I guess you could say, the fourth investigation of the Pizza Connection, was Rudolph Giuliani, currently running for mayor of New York City on the Republican ticket. That same Rudolph Giuliani also was in charge with investigating and prosecuting a group of people charged with smuggling arms to Iran. They quite apparently were part of the so-called enterprise, the Iranian arms deal, and some of the people also intersected with Cyrus Hashemi and some of the people that have been mentioned in connection with the October surprise scenario. The October surprise basically being a nickname attached to an apparent ploy that was affected by the Reagan campaign, in which before it even became an official organ of the government, when Ronald Reagan was running for president, the Reagan-Bush campaign made contact with the Khomeini government in Iran, worked out a deal whereby Khomeini agreed to hold the U.S. hostages from the U.S. embassy in Tehran until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. In return, the U.S., at first via the Israelis and then directly, shipped arms to Khomeini before his war against Iraq. That, in a nutshell, is the October surprise. We went into that in Radio Free America number 31. There's a book by that name out by Barbara Honegger, one of the people whose information figures in that particular broadcast. Well, that prosecution of some of these people related to the October surprise went no place. I theorize that perhaps this was a weak prosecution. That is frequently the case in national security issues, and it's frequently, that's one of the reasons why so often many of the culprits of many of the scams that we talk about on this broadcast wind up walking, even though their guilt would appear to be beyond doubt, at least up to a point. Anyway, Rudolph Giuliani, in my opinion, and I express this, it is my opinion, but I think the evidence is increasingly pointing in this direction, was an insider, was a key player with regard to the Iran-Contra scandal. It is my feeling that the limitation of Pizza Connection 4 and the dismissal of charges against the defendants in the Iranian arms smuggling case that I talked about in the December surprise, I don't feel those were accidents, and it is my opinion that Rudolph Giuliani was probably working deliberately on behalf of the Reagan administration. He is a Republican, and I theorize that the discussion concerning his possible mayoralty candidate on the Republican ticket would be a possible political payoff for his good works under the circumstances. Well, he is now running for mayor of New York. He's running behind, fortunately. Interestingly enough, though, upon leaving the federal government, and he resigned right after he busted Pizza Connection 4, although a very limited bust it was, as I mentioned, and right after he failed to get convictions in the Iranian arms smuggling case, Rudolph Giuliani left, went into private practice, and interestingly enough, went into practice for a law firm that had acted as an agent for the Panamanian government of Panamanian dictator Noriega. This information comes from the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, May 19th of 1989. This is a Reuters story, Dateline New York, and headline: New York law firm says it won't work for Noriega, and it reads as follows. White and Case, a New York law firm that is a registered agent of the government of Panama, said Thursday it would not represent the government so long as it is controlled by General Manuel Antonio Noriega. The law firm's association with Panama became public knowledge Wednesday when Rudolph Giuliani announced he was running for mayor of New York. White and Case hired Giuliani at a reported $500,000 a year last January, when he resigned after 6 years as a federal prosecutor. It has represented the Panamanian government since 1981. That would be roughly the period in which Noriega appears to have gotten involved with the Contra support effort. And again, we've talked about that in RFA programs 29 through 35 in various places. That is the Radio Free America archive series about the Iran-Contra scandal. And in the drug tug Lenvest case, Noriega figures prominently in the situation. And again, we'll be updating that next week. So here is, again, when I talk about the drug tug Lenvest case, here it's a local element which people here in the Bay Area can get involved with. It's a local element of the scam which people in the Bay Area may be able to affect directly. It's interesting, too, by way of discussing General Noriega, that one of his top security advisors is a former key Mossad, that's the Israeli intelligence service. He's a former key Mossad counter-terror expert, and although it's not mentioned here, Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute, the public interest law firm that is suing a number of the key defendants in the Iran-Contra scandal, he has mentioned Michael Harari as being heavily involved with, among others, George Bush, and figuring prominently in the background of the enterprise, so to speak. Interesting that this fellow is so prominently involved with General Noriega, because he touches upon some of the same elements that we've spoken about in the past. Reading from today's San Francisco Sunday Examiner, today being October 22nd of 1989, this is a story by Stuart M. Powell and John P. Wallach of the Examiner Washington Bureau. It's Dateline Washington, headlined, Israeli Working for Noriega, subheaded Ex-Mossad Agent Heads Intelligence for Panamanian. It reads in part as follows. To shore up his personal security to Panamanian General Manuel Antonio Noriega, Panamanian General Manuel Antonio Noriega has turned to a former Israeli agent to oversee Panama's troubled intelligence apparatus, the Examiner has learned. U.S. officials said Mike Harari, H-A-R-A-R-I, a retired Mossad operations director, has assumed day-to-day responsibility for the Panamanian Defense Forces intelligence branch. According to officials familiar with developments in Panama, Harari has replaced Colonel Guillermo Wong, W-O-N-G, the intelligence chief who was arrested following the failed coup attempt against Noriega on October 3rd. Harari is not only down there, but he is actively working for Noriega, said a senior White House official, skipping down. During his Mossad career, Harari led clandestine Israeli hit squads operating in Western Europe, exacting revenge for actions by the Palestine Liberation Organization. Israeli intelligence believed the targeted individuals played a part in the seizure and murder of 11 Israeli athletes during the Olympic Games in Munich in 1972. Harari reportedly was personally involved in one operation that went awry. Israeli assassins murdered a suspected PLO agent in Lillehammer, Norway in 1973, only to learn that the victim was an innocent waiter from Morocco. Well, it's interesting that this fellow was working for Noriega. Now, as I mentioned, although it's not discussed in this article, in a number of the talks that he's giving around the Bay Area, Daniel Sheehan, chief counsel for the Christic Institute, has mentioned Harari as not only involved with Noriega, but being heavily involved with George Bush and as part of the joint Israeli-U.S. counter-terror team, working with, among others, George Bush and many of the other key players in the Iran-Contra scandal at the time. Now, Harari is also mentioned in an article that appeared in Penthouse magazine in July of 1989 that eventually I hope to enter into the archives. God willing, and the creek don't rise, but there's so many things to put into the archives. But in an article called Snowbound by Ernest Volkman and I think it's John Cummings, either John or Richard Cummings, I've forgotten which, but Ernest Volkman and a fellow named Cummings, in the July 1989 issue of Penthouse, there's one of the best accounts of cocaine smuggling on behalf of the Contras, and Michael Harari is mentioned in that article in connection with the Contra support effort, and specifically with drug smuggling operations to finance the Contra effort in conjunction with Noriega. So it's interesting that he has now assumed apparent charge, at least according to this account, of the Panamanian intelligence apparatus. Now here's something to think about. If he has been a past player with George Bush, he might, and this is pure speculation, it's pure rumination, so if it turns out to be doo-doo, just put it on the garden, but he might, in a future more successful coup attempt against Noriega, he might be the inside player here. He might be the ace or the ringer here who to whom Noriega has turned, but who might actually turn on Noriega in a pinch. Let's just say, given this guy's background, and this fellow's no shrinking violet, he's run assassination and counter-terror teams, he's a veteran intelligence operative, he's worked with Bush, and counter-terror is as treacherous and double-dealing a field as you're going to find. He's worked with Bush in the past. If I were Noriega, I would not necessarily want Harari working for me. Let's just say maybe not. I don't know Harari personally, obviously. Maybe he's the most loyal creature in the world to Noriega. But let's just say keep an eye on future developments here, because this provides, for me at least, food for thought, and certainly I'm going to follow this up in the future, grounds for further research. In the event of the much ballyhooed coup against Noriega, we've heard a lot about it. We've seen the abortive coup attempt, and I'm going to discuss that in a second. Harari could be a key player, and he might be a double agent if, in fact, Bush is sincere about wanting to get rid of Noriega. And Noriega is very useful because he gives us a foreign enemy for the drug war between him and the Medellin cartel. It gives us somebody to feel threatened by and to wave the saber at as the red menace appears to be withering on the vine. The Soviet Union looks less and less threatening every day, and with glasnost, perestroika, arms reductions, etc., not to mention their own severe internal problems, increasingly the evil empire and the red menace looks less and less threatening. And the war on drugs, as I have hypothesized, may very well be what the national security establishment gives us in order to replace the Cold War. Something is going to have to be done to keep the American people embattled. And I wouldn't underrate Noriega as a useful figure in a Punch and Judy scenario. He's awfully useful. He's like Gaddafi. He's the man we love to hate. And it would almost be a liability, in my opinion, to overthrow him. Just like it would almost be a liability to overthrow Gaddafi, then you won't have him to kick around anymore. And that That's more useful than people might realize at times. Now, one of the things that I talked about in connection with the December surprise, to return to that scenario... before I go on to that, let me discuss briefly the abortive coup in Panama just today. And again, today is Sunday, October 22nd of 1989, for people who eventually hear this on tape. Just today, there has been discussion, and I haven't seen this in print, on the newscast, that the Bush administration is blaming the recent bungled Panamanian coup on some very severe limitations placed not only on the Bush administration's ability to act, not only on the president's ability to act, but also on the CIA by Congress. Okay, now, of course, congressional leaders from the Senate Select Committee and also people from the various intelligence oversight committees are denying this, but the Bush administration is claiming this. Now, a lot of things can go wrong in a covert operation, and the recent bungled coup in Panama may have been a bungled operation, but one of the things we have looked at in the past is evidence that when it suits them to do so, the elements of the U.S. national security establishment will deliberately sabotage an operation or will deliberately sacrifice something in order to achieve an end. Two examples that come to mind. In the Guns of November Part 1, the first part of a four-part archive series dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy, we discussed Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty's account of the Bay of Pigs invasion. And although the Bay of Pigs was another supposed bungled operation, Prouty presents a very compelling case that, in point of fact, the operation was deliberately sabotaged from within by renegade CIA officials who basically wanted to force Kennedy's hand with regard to Cuba and national security. They basically wanted to force Kennedy to send in the U.S. military against Cuba. In my opinion, and as in Prouty's as well, they were looking to test Kennedy and see where he was really at, so to speak, with regard to national security. Well, Kennedy did not commit the Air Force. Had the plan been followed, the original plan been followed, there would have been no need to involve regular U.S. Air Forces. It is Prouty's contention, and he makes an excellent case, that some of the same CIA officials who were later dismissed by Kennedy and helped orchestrate his assassination deliberately sabotaged the Bay of Pigs in order to force Kennedy into a more militaristic stance. Beyond that, there are serious indications, and we went into this in Radio Free America 31, that the Desert One rescue mission, the attempted rescue of the U.S. hostages in Iran in April of 1980, was deliberately sabotaged from within by members of the same Reagan-Bush back-channel intelligence network that helped effect the October surprise. These are two examples, and again, I have no first-hand information, obviously, about what happened with the Panamanian coup, but at the time, I had a hunch that there may be a lot more to this than what we've seen. Certainly operations get bungled, but our intelligence system is not, our intelligence agencies are not bunglers. They're extremely effective. That's not to say they're not immortal, they're not perfect, they can be resisted, but they're not bunglers either. They know what they're doing, and they're pretty damn good at it. And I just had a feeling when that happened that perhaps we were going to see the restrictions, quote-unquote, as if there were a great deal of restrictions placed, as if the restrictions were severe, but the restrictions placed on the intelligence community with regard to covert actions as a result of the Iran-Contra scandal, and those restrictions were symbolic, really, more than anything else, but that these would be blamed for the bungled operation, and that basically, again, it would be the kind of scenario that has been worked so successfully by the American right wing, by reactionary elements in this country. It's those pointy-headed liberals and those incompetent Democratic peaceniks who are tying the hands of tying the claws of the mighty American eagle, and basically have prevented us from dispatching this vile, ugly little Noriega, the corrupter of our children, the vile trafficker in drugs, etc., etc., etc. This is kind of like the stab-in-the-back scenario, which first reared its ugly head in Weimar Germany when the German national security establishment, the German military, and reactionary political forces in Germany blamed the German defeat in World War I on the abortive socialist uprising in Germany, which took place after the capitulation of the military in response to both that capitulation and to the very severe economic conditions in Germany as a result of the war economy and the British blockade. Basically, although the war was already over and a huge proposed American-French offensive had forced General Ludendorff to capitulate, basically his forces had no chance to resist the coming Franco-American offensive. Basically, that would have, in all probability, carried clear through to Berlin, because the American troops were fresh, German troops were exhausted, and the numerical odds were overwhelmingly in the Americans' favor. And Ludendorff had come to the conclusion that his exhausted army would just fold in front of this huge offensive by fresh troops. Basically, again, the stab in the back scenario, though, was offered up by the German military, by reactionary political elements, and ultimately the fascist elements that were to produce Hitler, as the explanation for Germany's defeat in World War I. This, in turn, served as a rationalization for effecting a program of political assassination of not only explicitly socialist and communist elements, but also all democratic elements in Germany that could have conceivably offered resistance to the rise of Hitler. Basically, we talked about that in Radio Free America number 10. This assassination program was carried out by the Reichswehr, so-called Black Reichswehr, by the Freikorps and the other volunteer military organizations put together in Weimar Germany. They then, when they were supposedly disbanded, they in fact remained intact and proceeded to pave Hitler's rise to power through a program of political assassination. The stab in the back scenario has also reared its head in an ugly and big way with regard to the U.S. national security establishment and its explanations for its defeats both in Korea and in Vietnam, or for the stalemate in Korea and the defeat in Vietnam. Again, the view within the national security establishment is that the U.S. has had its hands tied by these incompetent, pointy-headed, bleeding-heart civilians, and that's why basically MacArthur was removed in Korea and why he didn't get to drop the bomb on the Chinese, and that's why we lost in Vietnam. It's a very, very dangerous scenario, and as we've spoken about in the past, it appears to have served as a rationalization on the part of the national security establishment to undertake covert operations and commit assassinations here at home. So again, the stab in the back hypothesis is something to think about. I bring that up in this case because I think we're going to be seeing, certainly the Bush administration is already openly pursuing this line of argument, but we may see the recent, quote, bungled, unquote, coup against Noriega held up again as a stab-in-the-back hypothesis, or a stab-in-the-back explanation, and in turn we may see a drastic loosening of restrictions on covert operation as a result of the, quote, bungled, unquote, coup. And again, I wonder if that was deliberately bungled by the intelligence community in order to get much greater leeway with regard to covert operations. It's certainly something, it's not a conclusion we can draw at this point, but the debate appears to be moving in that direction, and it will be interesting to see just exactly how that debate is resolved. We're going to take another short musical break here, and then I'm going to come back with the conclusion of the December surprise scenario.
Down.
good evening. Welcome back once again to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. We're going to continue now with the December surprise update, and one of the things that I talked about in connection with the December surprise was the fact that a number of significant people died on that flight, and I suspected that they may have the computers which program airline reservations may very well have been utilized in such a way as to see to it that they were all on this flight. I cannot even begin to go into it here, but in a piece of research that I was privileged to do with the late Mae Brussel back in 1982, we were able to uncover not only connections between the airlines and the intelligence community, which stands to reason, and there are, in fact, whole CIA airlines, but between some of the major airlines and the CIA, and in turn, there are joint computer reservation operations between various airlines, including some of the airlines that intersect with the CIA. And again, I'm not talking about Air America, Southern Air Transport, etc. I'm talking about the major airlines, and many of them do intersect with the CIA. And again, it's very complicated. And we did this. I basically worked with Mae in a scenario she presented this way back in 1982. One of the things that I spoke about in connection with the December surprise was that a whole lot of interesting people died on that flight. Earlier I alluded to the State Department and intelligence community counter-terror experts. In addition, Bert Karlsson, who was the Swedish UN-appointed administrator for Namibia, and who was scheduled to sign the Namibian Peace Accord, the very controversial Namibian Peace Accord, controversial in part at least because the SWAPO forces are very dissatisfied with Bernt Carlson's successor, a Finnish gentleman who was the replacement administrator. In any case, he died on that flight. Rolof Pikbota, the South African foreign minister who was to have signed that accord with Bernt Carlson a few days later, was scheduled to be on that plane, but he canceled his reservation a couple of days earlier. Bear in mind now that the United States had advance warning that Palestinians, or that there would be a terrorist attack against a Pan Am flight originating in Frankfurt, West Germany in December of 1988. Well, in fact, there was. Whether or not Pikbota was tipped off remains to be seen. Also, a fellow named Michael Bernstein was involved with was killed in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, and he was an investigator on behalf of the U.S. Department of Justice, and specifically the Office of Special Investigations, which is the branch of the Justice Department in charge with hunting down Third Reich alumni Nazi war criminals in this country. Of course, their operations have been greatly limited because so many of those war criminals went to work for our intelligence system or our defense industries. But basically, Michael Bernstein was killed in that crash. I speculated, too, that given the intersections, as we've looked at a couple of weeks ago, given the intersections between the Third Reich intelligence residua, specifically the Galen Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit we took in at the end of the war, given the intersections between that, between Middle Eastern terrorism and between the fascist third position, and in turn, the intersection between that milieu and the Iran-Contra scandal, as exemplified by Odfried Hepp, Abu Abbas, Merex, etc. I went into that a couple of weeks ago. Basically, the death of Michael Bernstein may also have been a very convenient and useful death for the same forces that figure into the Iran-Contra scandal, the same reactionary and explicitly fascist forces that have been propelled into power by the series of assassinations beginning with President Kennedy's assassination in 63. That is the group, that is the renegade and dominant group within our national security establishment that has pretty much been running the show since and whose ultimate manifestation was the Reagan and Bush administrations. Basically, another very interesting person who was killed in the crash of Pan Am Flight, or the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, was a molecular biologist named Irving Seagal, capital S-I-G-A-L is his last name. He had just made a key discovery concerning the protein coat of AIDS, which offers at least the possibility of advances in the treatment of AIDS. And again, as I've said so often in the past, as we've discussed many, many times in the past, both archivally and otherwise, AIDS appears to be the application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. In Radio Free America program number 16, which at this point is hours and hours long, it was originally 4 hours and has been added to many times since, The working hypothesis that, in fact, AIDS is a biowarfare experiment is presented at considerable length. Because of that hypothesis and because of Irving Siegel's significance within the AIDS research community, I wonder, whether his death here was deliberately planned, whether he was programmed to be on this flight as well. Bear in mind that at the Christmas holiday, an awful lot of people are flying, and it may just be that since this plane was targeted, they saw to it that a number of political enemies, or as many as they could, were on this particular flight. The piece of research I alluded to earlier that I did with Mae Brussel indicates that such things are possible. Research credit on the following story goes to a listener who sent this in, and he researched this from the Wall Street Journal of February 16th of 1989. This talks a little bit about Irving Siegel, his discovery, his death in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, and his work for the Merck pharmaceutical firm, about which we'll have another word to say here in a second. This particular article, again, Wall Street Journal 2/16/89, is authored by or written by Michael Waldholz, or Waldholz, W-A-L-D-H-O-L-Z. It's headlined, Tracking a Killer. Merck scientists find a chink in the armor of the AIDS virus. Their discovery could lead to a drug that blocks virus from reproducing. Competitors race to follow. And the article reads in part, or a section of it reads, skipping down, in 1986, when Merck, M-E-R-C-K, started its research, scientists outside the company had dissected the AIDS virus into its component parts. Like all viruses, it fell into the twilight of a living and non-living organism, a few simple bits of genetic material inside an envelope of proteins. To reproduce, it must inject its genetic material into a cell and thereby commandeer the cell's genetic machinery, forcing the cell to replicate the virus. It is by this parasitic process that the AIDS virus perverts the body's vital white blood cells and destroys the human immune system. Despite this dissection of the AIDS virus, no one knew exactly how each of the various pieces worked, or their importance, or most of the big drug makers. AIDS work remained unrealistic until they could identify a target, a key piece of the... Let me read the last two sentences again here. The article's scotch-taped together and part of it here was obscured. In early 1980s, despite this dissection of the AIDS virus, no one knew exactly how each of the various pieces worked or their importance. For most of the big drug makers, AIDS work remained unrealistic until they could identify a target, a key piece of the virus critical to its behavior and yet vulnerable to attack. In early 1987, a young molecular biologist, Irving Siegel, S-I-G-A-L, and his colleagues at Merck's West Point, Pennsylvania labs were betting they had found a target on the AIDS virus that Merck could attack. Mr. Siegel was among those killed when a bomb exploded on a Pan Am jet over Scotland in December. But before he died, the 35-year-old researcher had spearheaded experiments that led to Merck's discoveries. Well, again, I wonder whether perhaps this discovery in some way displeased the authorities, the U.S. National Security Establishment, which almost certainly appears to have created AIDS, and or perhaps I wonder whether it was one of those competitors of Merck that might have wanted to steal a march on the company, or that resented their stealing a march on them. Both scenarios are possible, and it's possible that both are the case at the same time. It may be that some of the same national security elements that were involved in developing AIDS and spreading it are also involved with developing the cure. There are indications that's the case, or treatment such as it is. Both scenarios are possible, that this may have been a business rivalry and a possible national security case as well. Again, AIDS certainly appears to have been, the evidence points very strongly to AIDS as a biowarfare experiment. Whether or not that strong probability has anything to do with the death of Irving Siegel, his presence on Pan Am Flight 103, along with so many other key people, remains to be seen. Obviously, it's not a conclusion we can draw, but I think it's a question that we have to ask under the circumstances. Another piece of information may be relevant or may be apocryphal concerning Merck Pharmaceuticals and their intersection in the past with the U.S. National Security Establishment and biological warfare in particular. The founder of that company, George W. Merck, was the first director of the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program, U.S. Biowarfare Research, beginning during World War II, and it was George W. Merck who helped give the orders to continue biological warfare research at Fort Detrick. And, of course, it was Fort Detrick, the Army's top chem and biowarfare research center in Maryland, which was turned over to the supposedly civilian National Cancer Institute. That facility continued to be run, at least for a while anyway, by Litton Bionetics, a wholly owned subsidiary of Litton Industries' major defense contractor and a front for covert operations in the past. So again, the Merck pharmaceutical firm here, you know, it perhaps in some way may have been involved with some of the national security aspects of AIDS research. Again, simply so, it's a thought to bear in mind under the circumstances. We're going to touch briefly on Merck, George W. Merck, and his role in the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program. We're going to turn to a book which has been a mainstay in this type of research. It's called A Higher Form of Killing, in this research that we've done. It's called A Higher Form of Killing, subheaded The Secret Story of Chemical and Biological Warfare, co-authored by Robert Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S, and Jeremy Paxman, P-A-X-M-A-N. The book was published in softcover by Hill and Wang, and it's copyright 1982. And of George Merck, his work for the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Center, and his parenting, in a sense, of the post-war research at Fort Detrick, Paxman and Harris write as follows. In the United States, where nearly 4,000 people have been in it, now they're talking about germ warfare research during World War II here, beginning again. In the United States, where nearly 4,000 people had been employed at the four top-secret germ warfare installations by the end of the war, staff levels were initially reduced. But the man who had led American research into germ weapons during the Second World War, George W. Merck, M-E-R-C-K, of the Merck Pharmaceutical Company, recommended that the work continue. Camp Dietrich, the former National Guard airfield an hour's drive from Washington, was chosen for the purpose. So George W. Merck, of the Merck Pharmaceutical Company, the stepfather, so to speak, or the godfather of Fort Detrick. Now, of course, the National Cancer Institute's Molecular Oncology Institute installation, and quite possibly, as we have hypothesized, the key element, the key facility in the development of AIDS as a biowarfare weapon.